Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
And away we go. It's Hour 3 Oakley Show. We're just zipping along through the midweek edition. That means at this time, every Wednesday afternoon, we're joined in studio by our buddies in the round table. Ernie Eves, a former premier and finance minister in the province of Ontario. Good afternoon to you, Ernie.
Good afternoon, John.
Buzz Hargrove is a former national president of the Canadian Auto Workers and now distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University's Ted Rogers School of Management. Hello, Buzz.
Good afternoon, John.
Yeah, good to have you back. And John Turley Ewart, who is not just a commentator, but his bailiwick is strategic consulting, regulatory analysis, and risk mitigation. John, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Pretty good. You know, speaking of mitigating risk, I mean, the premier was up there in the court in Sudbury today. And, I mean, Ernie, you were there. You were a premier. You were also a finance minister. And, I mean, you were obviously in the halls of power. I mean, how is this playing out internally, do you think? I mean, is Kathleen Wynne, you know, acquitting herself rather credibly and admirably and, you know, in a way, maybe we'll turn this chicken, you know what, into chicken salad? How do you feel?
Well, to be fair, she's not charged with anything. She's appearing as a witness to see what she knew and when she knew it, if she knew anything. And my guess is that, surprise, surprise, she either won't remember what she did or said or doesn't know anything about it. And, you know, be that as it may, the court will ultimately determine what it thinks about the credibility of different evidence. But regardless, I think this can't be a good day for the Liberal Party of Ontario. I think it further feeds into the perception that's already there about several things. When you look at the gas plant scandal, you look at the hydro rate fiasco, you look at the huge debt that they've run up, e-health, you can go on and on and on.
You just like repeating the whole mantra, don't you?
I just don't think this helps feed into the public perception of what the current government represents. I don't think it's going to do them any good in the long run.
Well, you know, Ipsos came out with a poll on behalf of Global News earlier today, found that 24% of Ontarians believe the current government has done a good job and should be elected again. That's 24%.
I didn't know they had that many relatives.
Well, 76% say Ontario's due for a shakeup at the legislature. Here's how it breaks down. 39% of those polled said if the election were held today, they'd vote for the PCs, while 32% would support the Liberals, 22% would support the NDP. And we know that polls are not really a good gauge these days, especially, you know, as the technology has changed and the phones and everything. And ridings are like the Electoral College. You got to win those and not just, right, you know, the popular vote. But here's my question, and I'll throw it around the horn to John Turley Ewart. Is it enough for Patrick Brown, because he's the putative heir apparent here, and that's what the poll shows, is it enough to say, well, he's not her? Or does he have to be more emphatic and come out with some policies that he's not yet articulated?
I think he's got to define himself. I think his biggest fear has got to be a minority government, be it a Liberal one or even a Conservative one. I think it's very important for him to, I would say, walk a very straight line with people in Ontario. I wasn't pleased to see him get into this kerfuffle with Kathleen Wynne and mixing up, you know, what she's actually doing in court, because she's clearly not on trial. You know, that's kind of Trump speak. He's got to stay away from that kind of thing. And I want to see a principle-based leader.
How about it, Buzz? I mean, that's some say it's almost, you know, just as long as you know, walk the straight and narrow, don't get yourself in any trouble, a la Mr. Hudaker, Mr. Tory in days of yore, it's his to lose.
I don't think that works in Canada. I think in Canada people are looking for exactly what John said, for leaders to define themselves and a party to define itself by the policies that they put before the electorate during election time. And I think if there's any big mistake Brown is making, it's he's not getting ahead on that, not getting out there and keeping the debate on policy rather than on his good looks and charm.
Okay, well, or it's maybe it's early. I mean, you don't want, you keep your powder dry till you really need to expend it.
Here's the thing.
This is the head scratcher, though. Anybody can answer this. The poll shows the Liberals are the most popular party in Toronto and Northern Ontario. Ernie, I mean, when you were there in the Harris government, I mean, it was almost the same way, but you broke through.
Well, they have corner pot stores in Toronto. That may explain some of that.
Well,
they raided one today and arrested 20 people.
Well, okay, that's another issue we'll get to shortly. But how do you explain that Toronto still is a liberal bastion despite all of the things that you just articulated or enumerated moments ago? How do they continue to curry favor here?
Well, I think the city of Toronto proper, 416, as we would refer to them as voters, I think they've always been, A, fairly left and very urban-minded, as is understandable because they live in the largest urban municipality in Canada. And so I think parties that cater to their particular concerns and positions on different matters, it's understandable that they might look that way. But yet again, you look at Patrick Brown, the Conservatives, won a by-election in Scarborough, a seat that hadn't been held, I believe, ever by Conservatives. If it was, it was many decades ago. Anyway, I think that Patrick has made some inroads. Same thing in a by-election in Sault Ste. Marie, I believe it was.
Recently, yeah.
I mean, they won a seat there that hadn't been won since the Bill Davis years in 1981. Russ Ramsey, the former sports broadcaster,
right,
held that seat for a while. So I think they are making some inroads, but I think that there are certain pockets of support that every party has.
All right, but Toronto is fortress liberal. But the other question has to do with policy. And, you know, when we talk about the minimum wage, Buzz, you're a big backer of the $15 an hour minimum wage. Then the Financial Accountability Office comes out with a survey yesterday that says 50,000 jobs are going to be lost, primarily for teens and young people. And there was a piece in the Sun today where they asked a lot of small business operators, restaurateurs, Mark McEwen amongst them. He said, look, you know, it's such a razor-thin profit line that you've got to really figure out how you're going to work this in. And with a line item, the labor costs going up 32% over, you know, in the next 16 months or so, they can't square that with a cost or a price increase. They're going to have to let people go. So isn't that an ill-advised policy that they're still standing for?
No, there's no evidence. I'd love to see the basis that they make this charge that 50,000 jobs would be lost. The Ontario Chamber of Commerce said the number was 185,000. Every study that's come from the left has shown that there will be no job loss. Matter of fact, there's an opportunity for new jobs to be created because the people who get the increase will spend the money in their community. The kids that work here live here. Seniors that work here live here, spend their money here.
I'm saying the kids are not going to be working, though.
You could see a boost in job creation as opposed to a loss of
So you're saying the Financial Accountability Office, which is just an arm's length component of the government itself.
I'm not saying anything about them. I'm saying the Chamber of Commerce says they're wrong. Chamber of Commerce says they've been around a lot longer. They say 185,000 jobs. So ask yourself who's right and who's wrong. I prefer to deal on a positive note, which says there will be jobs created as opposed to jobs lost.
This is a fabulous day to hear Buzz promoting the Chamber of Commerce, cheering it on.
I want
loving
to mark
their numbers.
Mark this down.
Where's the real Buzz? Send in the real Buzz. This is his evil twin, Kyle.
Where did the real Buzz go in the last 2 weeks?
Right. You've been replaced. It's Night of the Living Dead. It's one of those things. Somebody's assumed Buzz's role here. All right, John, you wanted to complete the thought.
Well, I mean, the fact is that the vast majority of adults are not on minimum wage. The majority of people who make minimum wage are teenagers, are young people getting into the workforce. And that's the roadkill that, you know, this legislation is going to cause. And for Buzz to say, you know, they're going to put money into the economy, he's got to remember the price of living is going to go up. The cost of living is going to go up. And, you know, there's no doubt that people deserve to have a living wage, but there's different ways to do this. And I would suggest doing it within 16 months at 32% is too high. There's not one study to suggest that doing this within that time frame is actually going to work. There's studies in California, see them in the U.S., where it shows spread out over a longer period of time, it can have a positive impact in some instances, but it still hurts the lowest end of the workforce who get knocked out of employment opportunities.
Nine years since these people have had a wage increase. 9 years.
9 years?
Froze. Their wages have been frozen. Now we got an increase. Now ask yourself, did you get 32% over the last 9 years, John, in your income? I know I did. I bet you did. I bet Ernie did, yeah.
No, well, I didn't.
Yeah. Over nine years, my guess is you did.
But see, here's the issue.
Your suit costs more than most of these people make in a couple of years.
All right, well, hang on. It is a nice suit. I want to come back and pursue this in other veins, because there are a lot of policies that are rankling small business owners, and of course, we purport to represent on their interest. That's the so-called middle class, too, and Trudeau purports to represent their interest, and sometimes you have to wonder if that's the case. We'll get back into it with our panel, Buzz, Ernie, and John, in just a moment here on The Oakley Show. All right, back into it for our feisty affair with our three panelists on Wednesday. Ernie Eves, former premier of the province, Buzz Hargrove, former head of the CAW, and John Turley-Ewart, who works on Bay Street and on Wall Street, strategic consulting, regulatory analysis, risk mitigation. It's all about mitigating risk when you're in the crosshairs, figuratively speaking, of course, when you're a political leader. And this is where I've got to ask, because Justin Trudeau, oh, by the way, pursuant to our poll, we were just talking about the Ipsos poll that shows the Conservatives would win in the province of Ontario. They say Justin Trudeau is a unique celebrity. But he wouldn't be much help to Kathleen Wynne in the 905 because of the business tax issue. So 905 is going to be the battleground, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I would definitely think you have to make inroads if you're the Conservatives in the 905.
Yeah, all right, for sure.
And the business tax issue that they allude to is the one that we've talked about on several occasions, and it's gained additional currency where there's, as Patrick Gossage last hour was saying, you know, that's quite a lobby group that has the media's attention. And I'm saying, what lobby? It's 1.8 million small business operators and owners and professionals and so on and so forth. This is an interesting email that I got from Roberto. He says, hi, Johnny. These changes proposed by the federal government are plain morally wrong. The matter is even worse when you consider the hypocrisy. The very people proposing these changes, the Prime Minister and Bill Morneau, have all their cash tax sheltered. The Prime Minister from his teacher and political defined benefit pensions, and Bill Morneau can add his offshore business to that. How is this not front page news? And then he attaches an article from Spencer Fernando. And it says, while Justin Trudeau targets Canadian family farms and small businesses, his government refuses to crack down on the use of offshore tax havens by the top 1%, like elitist finance minister Bill Moneybags Morneau. John Turley-Ewart, is this guy right?
Well, I would say that, you know, Morneau is sort of the modern-day R.B. Bennett. You know, sort of we have a plutocrat as a finance minister here. And why the left isn't jumping all over that, I don't understand. This is a fellow who, you know, has, you know, obviously he's a successful business person, but he's far removed from the day-to-day experiences of small business people, which is very clear from, you know, this proposed legislation where you want to take away the ability of people who are small business people to fund their own pensions and ensure that they can, you know, live a decent life once they retire.
Well, and this is the interesting thing, because it's a wedge issue. It's being positioned as fairness, tax fairness, and going after the wealthy and the tax cheats and so on and so forth, like they're a privileged class. But Buzz Hargrove, you know, it's dawned on me that the real privileged class, or if you want to talk about a class that's privileged insofar as this Canadian landscape is concerned, what about the public sector? I mean, their pay, pensions, and benefits exceed anything that you've got in the private sector for the most part. Is it time maybe the Liberals started looking at them for touching them up?
Well, first, I don't accept the premises that the public sector have this great, big, beautiful wage. A lot of them are paid a lot less than people in the private sector who do
their overall compensation package.
The same work. I'm talking about overall compensation.
Defined benefit pensions?
From pensions, there's still, it's getting smaller every day, but a number of people in the private sector who get defined benefit pensions. The real question here is, are the Liberal Party going to be able to handle the dissent internally? Wayne Easter, who's, as I understand it, the chair of the Finance Committee for the Liberals, he came out in opposition today. He said he took a real beating when he went back to Prince Edward Island on this issue. So I think there's going to be a head of steam, even more so now that the Parliament's coming back to stop this. So it'll be a real surprise to me if they're able to move ahead, given the opposition of the Liberal members themselves.
All right. I didn't want to let the original question go. John Turley-Ewart, when it comes to the public sector, is it time for maybe the government to take a look at that? I mean, the labor component within the overall public sector, the costs, that's 85% of the costs of these big budgets. I mean,
There is no doubt that there, you know, spending on the federal government has gone up and up and up and up. And there's always room to find savings, particularly when we're running deficits now. I think there's no question about that. I'm not a big fan of what I call envy politics. That's typical of the left, where they see people who are successful and they want to knock them down. You know, if someone, you know, does a good day's, you know, work in the government, sure, they get a fair wage, they get a fair pension. But the question is, what can we afford? And I think for a long time, federal governments and provincial governments have been essentially buying votes through the kind of pay packages and benefit programs that they deliver to the public sector. And I think that's something we have to think about.
I think if you look at the Liberals have only been elected 2 years, and John says that the spending's gone up and up and up and up. Well, Harper was the spendthrift. He was in power for 10 years. So you have to look where it comes from. It's not Trudeau couldn't possibly have made that kind of change in 2 years.
But Harper actually balanced the books for the most part while he was there, and Trudeau ran on, albeit, you know, running a deficit. Originally, it was going to be no more than $10 billion, and it ended up being closer to $50 billion in his first year, so not too good at math.
Right.
And this year, it's also quite substantial. And we have the finance minister saying, we have no idea when we can balance the books. Yet Trudeau ran on, the books will be balanced in 4 years' time.
But our economy, Ernie, has never been better. Unemployment has never been lower. Our economy is booming right across the country. Even Alberta's bouncing back now. So you can't be critical of what they're doing. They're getting people back to work, which is important.
Wow, this is Budge Chamber of Commerce come back again. Like, are you trying to tell us that the quality of jobs that you see today are the same as they were in the past? I mean, particularly in Ontario, Buzz, you know that the manufacturing sector has been killed.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I'm the one makes the argument on the manufacturing sector. And there's some things that we still should be doing in Ontario that the Liberal government of Ontario and the Liberal government in Ottawa aren't doing.
Well,
NAFTA is one opportunity, and I like the argument from the unions now that they should, if they want to sign NAFTA again, they should force Trump and them to pass a federal law getting rid of right to work, which is a huge subsidy to the business community in the United States.
Well, that's never going to happen. But going back to the original point of tax fairness a few minutes ago, you know, trying to attack small business as if they're some elitist group that make millions of dollars a year apiece, all the small mom-and-pop operations, all the farmers across the country. I mean, if you really want to do something about tax fairness, there are a lot of people in the elite 1% of income earners in this country that pay very little, if any, tax at all, like zero. Why don't you go after them? And the reason, I suspect, is because they have a lot more influence with the government. They're the friends and contributors and supporters of the government, so we wouldn't want to touch them, would we?
That's the swamp that Donald Trump was talking about, or Steve Bannon on 60 Minutes on Sunday. But what you're saying is, you know, when the government talked about increasing the cadre of auditors with the CRA to go after the Panama Papers showed that there was a lot of offshore money, our colleague Lou Skeezus, your buddy Buzz, actually did call it out, I think correctly, by saying, you know, they'll hire all these people, but the smart money is going to dodge them. So they're going to find the soft touch and they're going to go after the so-called tax loopholes that accrue to the benefit of small businesses and so on and so forth. And that's probably what's playing itself out.
Well, right, I don't think they're tax loopholes. They like to call them that. That's political spin, in my opinion. They are tax policies that encourage small business operators to invest in the country and to employ other people.
Exactly.
There are tax laws that have developed over many, many years by parties of all political stripes.
All right, so there's a consensus that these things are legitimate tax vehicles to encourage or incentivize people to build. Again, Chamber of Commerce Buzz Hargrove.
they are today, but I'm not sure whether they're going to withstand the...
The hell with this Ted Rogers School of Management thing the Chamber of Commerce is calling.
I'm going to have to take you to my tailor and have a Canadian suit made for you, Buzz. Nice blue one here.
The last poll that I read on the broader public view of this, 75% of people support them making the change.
Yes, but yes, they probably would, because they are left with the perception that all these people are making hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars a year, and yes, they should pay their fair share.
All right, let's come back in a moment. One more segment. We'll fill it out with Ernie Eves, Buzz Hargrove, and John Turley Ewart on The Oakley Show. Talk radio, AM 640. 635. Coming up in 10 minutes' time, Ontario Housing Minister Peter Milchin is going to join us. The province has made an announcement earlier today. They're unlocking surplus provincial land to create more than 2,000 new rental housing units in Toronto. in Toronto, part of the Fair Housing Plan. And where would that be? Well, that's down by the waterfront, the West Don Lands, and just south of Front Street between Trinity and Cherry, not too far from the Distillery District, and the Don Lands east of Cherry Street, north of the rail line. Hey, I don't want to jump the gun here, but that sounds to me like prime real estate. John Turley Ewart, I mean, this is going to be 2,000 affordable housing units. Does this make sense to you?
It makes no sense to me. And the whole term surplus land makes it sound like, you know, land that's not used, hasn't got any value. I mean, this is nonsense. The City of Toronto is selling land all over the City of Toronto to developers for huge amounts of money. They spend tons of time and effort hiring consultants to value that land so they can get the most out of it. What this is undoubtedly a subsidy to low-income people at the expense of taxpayers so that they can live on some of the most expensive land in this city right on the waterfront.
And how does Buzz feel about that?
Well, first, it's not 2,000 affordable housing units. It's 2,000 housing units, a third of which will be for low-income people. I think it's great. The only question I'm asking of where have they been? Why haven't we released some of this property? We've been going through a crisis in the City of Toronto with prices going up ridiculously high that most ordinary people, most middle-class people can't afford housing in Toronto, let alone low-income people. So where have they been? That would be the question I would ask the minister.
But you know what the question is I would ask, sorry, I just want to interject, is why wouldn't you sell that land, get the most for it, and use that money to then build more affordable housing than that 33%?
Well, where do you get the property? You got to have the property.
There's property all over Toronto. City of Toronto has tons of property all over the city. It's for sale everywhere. You see the signs up all the time. So why wouldn't they sell that, get the most for it, and then maximize the number of affordable housing units they can create rather than have this, like, you know, sort of showboating thing where, you know, you put something down on the waterfront and have a nice photo op?
Well, and not to mention the backlog and repairs and the billions of dollars with Toronto Community Housing and a lot of the derelict units that basically have to be scrapped because they can't be remediated. My colleague John Turley Ewart makes a good point, doesn't he, Ernie?
He does make a good point. I think there are other ways of encouraging, you know, low-cost housing, and I would agree with Buzz to the extent that I don't see anything wrong with a certain percentage of these units being that. But I also like John's point that, you know, this land is very valuable, so perhaps developers should be paying for it, and perhaps there's some way of giving them a tax benefit for the number of low-cost housing units that they decide to put in it. But I don't think we should be giving the land away.
By the way, one final word, Ernie, on Monday. I know it's always an honor to be a part of your golf tournament in honor of your late son, Justin Eaves, and the Justin Eaves Foundation. And it helps kids, gives them bursaries and scholarships because they have learning disabilities. Now, the New Democrats have set up a private members bill. They want to see a new Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions in the province. Good idea or not?
Well, I think it's certainly an issue that needs, that's a huge area and becoming more and more prevalent all the time. I think it's a societal concern that has to be addressed. I wouldn't necessarily be against that at all.
Good idea.
I believe the government of British Columbia moved first on this issue, and they've actually got a ministry that looks after mental illness and addiction. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, it's needed. Look, there's not enough beds for people with mental illness issues. People are wandering the streets in cities in Toronto and across the province. You know, it's got to end.
All right. Well, by the way, you just tweaked me to something where invariably when we talk about that, it comes back to the rejoinder. That's because Mike Harris emptied the institutions. Ernie, did you want to respond to that?
Well, I think the whole approach to healthcare, whether it's mental health or physical health, has changed over the years. And it's no longer the best solution to everybody to institutionalize them. I mean, if you can get help at home or closer to home or in group homes or whatever, I think that's probably become far more in vogue as the way to deal with people and make them more inclusive, as opposed to just setting them in a building somewhere and saying, there they are.
All right. Well, the standalone ministry, if Andrea Horvath gets her way with a private members bill, would do a lot to advocate for the people who are increasingly in need. I think we've all agreed on that point, and we'll end on it. I thank you all. It was a great session, as always. Ernie Eaves, John Turley Ewart, and Buzz Hargrove, or at least somebody presenting himself as Buzz from the Chamber of Commerce.